Welcome to a special episode of Skin in the Game. I'm Tim Elshai, sports business journalist with the Buffalo News and co-host of this fine podcast with John Simperman. John's away this week, but I'm here with you and we've got a great show lined up that looks back at some of our favorite guests in one of my favorite sports, baseball. Each guest provides a unique perspective on America's favorite pastime. First up, Michelle Siniak, Senior Vice President of Fan Experience and Concessions with the Toronto Blue Jays. Let's listen in.
But what I get to do every day is take care of all of the fans that come into our building. And myself and my team, I like to say we're the cherry on top of the baseball experience. So you're coming to watch baseball, but then everything that my team gets to do is that little bit extra that you love to take part in at the ballpark. So whether you are buying your favorite player jersey, or if you are getting your favorite food from the concession stand, or you are interacting with your favorite usher in your section, or whatever it may be, that's my team. That's everyone on the ground who gets to welcome all of our fans who enter the ballpark every day.
Wow. Well, that probably includes, 100 or so ushers? I mean, this is a big team.
It's a big team. We have, we have a lot of folks on the team. So we have our ushering team. We have our gate staff team, who are the incredible folks that welcome you. We have our access support team, who help any guests with accessible needs. We have our promotions team, our activation team, who help you out maybe getting your giveaway or taking part in a Junior Jays activation. Our retail team, our concessions, fan services. We have it all. They are the best.
Hey, Michelle, it's Tim Elshai. Thanks for joining us on Skin in the Game. Cannot wait to dig into just how you make that all work and doing it every night during these long homestands, too. It's a little bit, maybe a lot different from other major league sports. Before we get there, though, give us a little bit of background on you. We know you've been with the Blue Jays for 14 years. Tell us about your path up in the organization and what brought you there in the first place.
So I started here in 2012 was my first year full time. And I was actually lucky enough to freelance for my current boss, Marnie Starkman, and who was my first boss here as well when I became full time. But I freelanced in the 2 years before that, just getting to know the organization and freelancing in game entertainment. My background is in dance and theater, which is an interesting background. And then I went into public relations and communications after my university degree in arts and fine arts. So I come from a hodgepodge, if you will, of backgrounds that brought me to sport. But my, start in sport was through dance. And I worked in the CFL as a Toronto Argonauts cheerleader. So that's really where I fell in love with the industry. But I also grew up a longtime Blue Jays fan. Our family dog was named Olerud after first baseman John Olerud. So a lot of sports in my family that brought me to my position today.
That's awesome. And Michelle, with the role of leading fan experience, and I guess kind of dating to my days back running marketing for a few teams, I used to always, people said, what is your job, John? Right? Come on. I said, my job is to really minimize the effect of losses and maximize the potential of wins, right? But so much of that is really, I think, that fan experience, because me nor you can affect what happens, between the lines. But boy, we can sure affect how people are greeted, how they're treated, and how they feel at the end of the game.
Exactly. That's a perfect way to put it. And when we have new team members who start with us, whether full-time or on our game day staff in a part-time capacity, you always remember your experience when you come to a game, whether it was with your family or your friend, or maybe you brought your niece or your nephew. Very few times do you actually remember the score of the game or what happened on the field. And so it really is about the memories that you create or that experience that you had when you come to, a ballpark, or if you're going to a football stadium or a theater or whatever it may be. And that's exactly it. It's on us to make sure that we're creating those great experiences for people as they come into our building.
Rogers Center has gone through a multi-year renovation and needs to serve not just baseball fans, but concert goers. Now here we're thinking Taylor Swift, Jonas Brothers, Lady Gaga. I asked Michelle to talk not only about the challenges, but also the opportunities of serving so many different crowds.
Now it is still multi-purpose and we still have concerts here and different events, but we were able to change the experience to create social spaces and cool bars and places where we can play music and really create these spots that folks want to come to, whether it be they want to come just for baseball or they want to come to hang out with their friends. So that was phase one. And then phase two, we took out our entire lower bowl, all of our 100 level. We dug it down to nothing and then built it all back up, focusing on our player facilities, but also the 100 level seats and adding a really incredible premium experience with new premium clubs.
Wow. Wow. I'm really excited about the social gathering places. I recently toured Progressive Field in Cleveland, had the opportunity last year to head out to San Diego and see Petco. And what I love, and I love what you just said there too, is these social, these communal areas. And what I noticed, and maybe you do up there as well, is I noticed they attract a lot more younger fan base who may not necessarily be there for the game per se, but they want to be there for their friends. They want to socialize. I think those spaces are really exciting.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It is. We're definitely seeing a younger fan. I will say, though, the social spaces are filled with all walks of life and all different types of folks, different age groups. But it's people who might not necessarily be there just for the baseball game. Maybe their one friend is really into the game, but the rest of them just want to come and experience what it's like in the ballpark. Corona Rooftop Patio is one of my favorite spots to be. We have programmed that space to be the ultimate patio. I would say the best patio in the city. But we have music. We have acoustic music or DJs that play all throughout the game. So if you want to watch the game, you can do so. But if you want to watch the game on TV, it sounds funny, and, you know, listen to the music and have a drink with your friends, you can do that too. And we've gotten a lot of great feedback on that patio.
Tim, it sounds like you and I are going to be making a trip up to the Corona patio
soon. Oh, I think we will be doing that very soon. Yeah, Michelle, if you want to come join us there.
Happy to have you anytime. There's some great frozen margaritas up there, so we can have a frozen margarita on the rooftop patio.
We will take you up on that. I was looking at the, I'm on your website, and there was an image that I wanted to show John. I'm looking at the food and beverage offerings in the outfield district here. Is that cotton candy poutine I'm looking at here by any chance?
Yes, you are.
Oh, tell us about that.
This year. So that is a chef creation from our Rogers Center chefs. And they just, you know, they're always looking to bring new and diverse food into the ballpark. And, you know, we want it to be that food item that people talked about and something new. And Canadians are known for their poutine. So it is cotton candy fries. I will say it's not for everyone. I personally really like it. It's got like a garlic base, but then also the sweetness of the cotton candy. So if you're into a savory sweet type of vibe, it's certainly something that you'd want to try if you were coming here.
I'm looking at John now. He's got a smile on his face. That's telling me. Does this mean you want it?
Michelle, as you'll see on Skin in the Game, we actually talk a lot about food. So we're intrigued by what some of the ballparks are doing, getting really innovative, really creative. And what I think that's a great example is it's that Instagrammable moment, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's shareable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Legends is your food and beverage provider, right?
They are, yes.
Yeah.
We made the switch to Legends a few years ago, and they've been incredible partners as we have gone through our renovations. They helped us in consulting on our renovations as well, because a huge portion of the renovation was food and beverage. So they were great thought partners in helping us work through what those were, and they continue to be as we change the F&B experience here for our fans every day.
I'm glad Michelle spoke with us a little bit about Legends. They're one of the leaders in venue experiences, and I've been curious about them because they were recently named as a company who will handle food and beverage in the new Buffalo Bills Stadium. That begins in the 2026 season. Next up was a fascinating conversation with Mike Buczkowski from Rich Entertainment Group. Mike is the president of baseball operations, which means he oversees not only the Buffalo Bisons, but also the Northwest Arkansas Naturals, who are a AA affiliate of the Kansas City Royals, and also the West Virginia Black Bears, a single-A affiliate of the Pittsburgh Pirates. John and I talked with Mike about the Diamond Group, who, if you watch baseball, you know has been aggressively buying up minor league teams around the country. We also picked Mike's brain about who he's keeping an eye on in the baseball landscape, essentially who is on his teams to watch list. The answer might surprise you. It's probably not what you think.
We talked about in the episode past about Diamond Baseball Holdings coming in, and I guess in many cases it's private equity that's purchasing a lot of these minor league teams. Any thoughts of the Rich Baseball Properties looking at other markets or growth, or are you guys really content where you are?
I think for now we are. I mean, we're always open. We're every year we probably look at two or three opportunities. I think we wanted to see how the dust settled with the new Major League Baseball setup and what that was going to mean long term, because we all are operating under different rules and different responsibilities, different requirements now. And so I think we wanted to see where that was shaken out. But yeah, the Diamond Group, they're up over 40 teams, 40 minor league teams. They have a cap. They're allowed to own 50, and okay. They have stated they want to get to 50.
Yeah.
And so I think part of it is you think that's good, right? Private equity people usually are buying things that they believe have growth and have a good future. Just wonder how long they're going to own the teams,
because usually
you don't if you're private
equity. Right, right. And, you know, the thing about private equity is they're also looking for efficiencies, right? And I think they have said that, you know, they're not going to, quote unquote, outsource, right? Whether it's ticket sales or whether it's, you know, the concessionaire job. Mm-hmm. So I from what I hear, that is the case. But, you know, it would be a shame if they really focused on slashing the experience for the sake of more profit.
Yeah, and so far they haven't. They've kept every team that they've purchased, they've kept the president in place, or at least offered the president and general manager to stay. They still have full staffs at all of their teams, so they're still young in the game, but so far they've done what they say they're going to do, and they bring a wealth of experience too to minor league baseball, which is good for us.
That's
because
great.
We can, you know, we can tap into some of the resources that they have as an industry.
Tim, I'm going to throw a question at that Mike that isn't on any of our earlier discussion points, but I've got to know because I get asked a lot because I'm an old time baseball guy. We and Tim, as are you. You love baseball. Mm-hmm. And I get asked probably once a week, are the Savannah Bananas good for baseball or are they bad for baseball?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, if you go, and they were here last year for three games, if you go, it's as fun as anything you've ever attended. I mean, it's great, you know. But I think it also has said to people, well, why can't professional baseball, why can't you do some of those things, you know? Why can't you do some of that? Well, you know, there is an integrity of the game.
Have there been, and maybe in any of the Rich properties, is there an idea or two that you might have borrowed?
Yeah, oh, no doubt. I mean, some of the things they do, we have 2 minutes between innings to entertain. They can do whatever they want. But yeah, we looked at some of the things they've done, and they do a great job. This year, they're only doing major league parks. They're not even doing.
Well, they're also doing a NASCAR racetrack.
A racetrack, yeah. And a football stadium somewhere. The next one to be watching out for is Cosmic Baseball.
Uh oh.
And we're hoping to get that in 2026. That's blue, black light, and with glow in the dark uniforms.
So it's like the Blue Man Group?
Yeah, right. Okay.
But
playing baseball. So it's going to, I think you're going to see more and more ideas as the Bananas continue to be successful.
I've got to say, Tim, though, and I'm going to tell you, Mike, too, the one idea I do love coming out of Banana Ball, though, is it's an out if the fan catches the ball.
I love that, yeah.
You know what that would do? It would keep people off their phones.
That's right.
And they would actually be watching the batter instead of having their face in the phone.
And they're present in the moment.
Exactly. Yeah.
They'd bring a glove. They might not, depending if it's the other team hitting the ball, maybe no one fights over the ball. Just let me catch it because it's an out.
We wrapped up the conversation about something that's a little personal to me because I grew up as a baseball fan in Buffalo, not only watching the Bisons, but watching all these characters who were in the stands. And that includes fans, but it also includes people who actually work for the Bisons, even beer vendors, like this guy called the Earl of Bud. If you haven't heard about him, you're about to. I want to ask you, too, about the characters that, again, if somebody's like me and been a Bison fan for a long time, they'll remember people like the Earl of Bud, which we'll explain the Earl of Bud in a moment. You know Conehead. You brought him up on this program a couple of weeks ago. And we could go on, and there's fans who are, who bring personality to the games. Same question. How has that evolved over the years?
I think in the earlier, like Earl of Bud, I mean, he's Buffalo institution. And John, I can't believe it. Never.
You got to give John the 101.
Yeah, he beer vendor, Earl of Bud, vended Bud, wore a white tuxedo.
Remember, I'm still new to Buffalo. Yeah. I've only been here 25 years.
Yeah, you're a newcomer for sure.
White tux, red Converse sneakers, and we would play the tequila song. And no matter where he was, he would put his beer down, go running down the stairs, jump onto the dugout, and do the Pee Wee Herman dance tequila. The other teams would stop. The whole place would stop to watch the Earl of Bud, the Earl of Bud dance. And but all the ballparks have characters. You mentioned Mark, one of our super fan Mark. We did a bobblehead of last year. But it seems like wherever any minor league park, especially, there's always the local kind of characters that people love and get to know that you just don't see at a major league. You just don't see it at a major league. Any major league sport, whether it's hockey, football, or baseball. We are baseball, but it's also family entertainment. We can't control our players, who's going to be here, who's not. But what we can control is your experience when you come. How good is the food? How clean is the place? How safe is it? You know, and how fun is it? Probably the one advantage we have over our friends at the Bills and the Sabres is, you know, you can come to a Bisons game on a Friday night with your kids, not spend a ton of money, have a great time. Your kids get a giveaway. They meet the mascot. They're on the video board. They see a great fireworks show. And the Bisons can lose 10-0. And people are walking out saying, we got to do this again. We got to come back again. And I always say, there's not a fireworks show in the world the Bills could do that lose 48-0 where people are going to walk out going, well, this was fun.
Yeah.
This was a fun
day. Let's do that again.
Yeah, let's do that again. It's all about winning, which it should be at that level. But yeah. Kind of the niche we have is, you know, you can be entertained and you can do it for a good value.
Too. Yeah. Flipping to kind of present day. And by the way, when I did move here 25 or so years ago, Mike, it was my Cleveland Indians who you were affiliated with. And yeah, there are a few Hall of Famers, or hopefully future Hall of Famers, came through Buffalo with those teams. Now we're with, which I think makes a ton of sense, proximity, the Toronto Blue Jays. How has that relationship been?
It's really been great. I mean, even aside from the Blue Jays coming here for playing here for two seasons, you know, just the proximity, you know, the business side of it, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is what the current situation, but the number of Canadian fans that now are coming to our ballpark to see the future Jays. When we had Vlad Guerrero and Kevin Biggio and Bo Bichette especially, but guys will be on rehab, they'll come down for a game. Of the people that buy individual game tickets for the Bisons, almost 20% come from Southern Ontario.
Yeah, and that's higher than both the Bills and the Sabres.
Yeah, and that's a big number for us. So having that affiliation, creating this baseball corridor, so to speak, from Buffalo to Toronto, and the relationship of how we help market each other's products, you know, the Blue Jays are promoting the Bisons, we promote the Blue Jays. I think has created, I see a lot more Blue Jays hats and shirts than I used to see. Still see too many Yankee shirts and hats, but
by the way, again,
can never get rid of those.
By the way, Cleveland guy here. Yeah, yes, yeah, I agree.
Too many, right? Maybe one's too many, maybe two.
And Mark Shapiro, I had a chance to work with him back in Cleveland, and great, salt to the earth, hardworking guy.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm sure that helps. You alluded to it. We're obviously having some tariff issues and some other issues coming out of D.C. between the relationship with our neighbors up north. Are you starting, unfortunately, to see the effect?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, we use that 20% mark, and it's early in the season still, obviously, for us. But, you know, we're less than 10% of the people buying individual tickets are coming from Canada. We've talked to them. We've surveyed them. We've stayed in touch. I think the predominant answer is, we love coming to the Bisons, but until something changes, we're going to take a pass for a while.
It's hard to know exactly how that story is going to end. I suspect it's going to continue to develop, and we might be talking about it next baseball season, too. Next up, we'll hear more about Cosmic Baseball, and we also sit down with Kate Brownell, who pitched a perfect, perfect game against an all-boys Little League team. We're going to find out how that day changed her life. We'll be right back.
I'm excited to see, like, she said this, well, he said that.
The truth will come out.
Wondering what the buzz is?
What's the hot goss? Whatever it is, we're talking about it on Group Chat, your weekly connection to the unpredictable, weird, and wonderful world of pop culture. From film, music, theater to food, blockbusters, and beyond. Every week with Tiffany Bentley and her revolving panel of pop culture enthusiasts. Listen to Group Chat on Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at noon on BTPM NPR.
I'm very excited.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to our special Skin in the Game episode celebrating baseball. I'm Tim Elshai. I'm so excited next to introduce you to Kate Brownell, who pitched a perfect game against an all-boys Little League team. We met about 10 years ago when I was her professor at SUNY Buffalo State University. Now, I got to tell you, I had no idea who this person sitting in my classroom was until she came up to me one day and said, "Hey, professor, I'd like to get into sports media." It turns out she already had a little bit of experience with that. Let's listen back.
Take us back to May 2005 and what happened on that one particular afternoon.
May 14th, 2005, the game that changed my life for sure. I had a little league game. I played boys baseball. We actually had picture day, so we were there early. Coach is like, "Hey, Kate, go warm up. We're going to pitch the first four, and then John, my shortstop, was going to go in to pitch the fifth and sixth inning of that game." So we're going along, and my mom comes over in the fourth inning of the game. We were playing the Yankees at the time. I played for the Dodgers. She's like, "Bug," because that was my nickname back then. She's like, "Bug, you're pitching a perfect game." I'm like, "All right, cool." Like, I have no idea what the heck that is. I'm just throwing the ball, hitting the ball, running around the bases, doing what I love, playing with the boys. And that next inning, I was supposed to go to short, but my bookkeeper is looking at the book, and he's like, he told my coach, he said, "Hey, we can't take her out now. She's pitching a perfect game." But again, I didn't know what the heck that was. So I just did what I was supposed to do, and I went back out to the mound. I struck out the next side, all three, came back in. Sixth inning, got the first two, last batter, fouled off a couple over the backstop. And I struck him out, pitched the perfect game, and my team came flying out. My coaches hugged me. "Oh my God, you did it. I was like, "Did what?" Like, I just pitched. We won 11-0. I think I had a home run that game as well. So I was just thrilled to win. As soon as we shook hands and stuff, my brother, he's one of my brothers. He's 10 years older than me. He knows all about baseball, a big baseball lover, and he's telling me about how awesome it was and how, like, nobody ever does this. I remember I had called my dad because he's a truck driver, and he would not believe what I did. He's like, "No, you didn't." I was like, "I don't know. Here, talk to mom." So my mom told him, and he was like, "We got to call the president of the league." And so we made that call. And the president of the league actually called just our local newspaper. And ever since that first story, it just went bonkers.
I remember the New York Times covered this. I was writing for Buffalo Business First at the time and was asked to interview you and actually wrote your family a letter that you did. I don't think you guys ever opened. You actually showed it to me 12 years later. You said, "My mom was going through some old files and I have this letter from you." there were a lot of people trying to get your attention, including the president of the United States. So we can come back to that. But suffice it to say, Katie Brownell at the time, made national news, got the attention of sports fans everywhere. I know the Baseball Hall of Fame wanted your jersey, and you were reluctant to give up your jersey at first. And then it occurred to you the Baseball Hall of Fame might be a worthy recipient, right?
Well, yeah. So I didn't, honestly, like, I didn't even know that existed. Like, I truly just played the game that I loved. I grew up with my brothers. I'll never forget, I was sitting in the parking lot with my mom, waiting to go in the grocery store, and the Hall of Fame called her, and she's like, "The Hall of Fame, like, whatever," you know, she's all excited. And I'm sitting in the passenger seat and I can sort of hear what they're saying. And my mom covered the phone a little bit and she goes, "The Hall of Fame wants your jersey." And I said, "No, that is my jersey and I am not giving it up." And she's like, she hung up the phone and stuff and she started talking to me and she's like, "Kate, you don't understand. Like, this is where, like, Babe Ruth is and, you know, naming all the Hall of Famers." And she's like, "I'm sure you can get another jersey."
I think, Kate, you made the trip to Cooperstown, right? It was a benefit. You brought the whole team came along as well.
Yeah. July 7th of that year, 2005. We had to bring the team. Maria Pepe was there, who paved the way for all the women, which was really awesome. She got to sit right up there with me.
Have you been back since?
I have actually. I gave a speech to over 100 women. I want to say that was 2018 or 2019, which was really awesome. I've been able to bring my nieces to show them the jersey. So I've definitely been back a few times, but I think I'm due for a trip, especially since it's been 20 years.
In the last 20 years, there have been some significant changes in opportunities for women in baseball and softball. That includes the Athletes Unlimited Softball League, which began play this year.
Kate, how excited are you for the Athletes Unlimited Softball League, which, of course, had that existed when you were playing softball as a teenager, that would have given you a pro league to aspire to, right?
Yes, for sure. Being able to turn on the TV now for all those little girls and see, like, oh my gosh, I could totally do that. Whereas when I was younger, like, I turned it on and watched MLB, and I still remember one of my interviews, the anchor had asked me, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I want to be the first female in the MLB, because that's all that I saw was Major League Baseball. Whereas, like, now these little girls can look and watch these professional softball players killing it and know, like, hey, I could be there one day, you know? So I think that had I had that when I was younger, I would have probably transitioned to softball sooner, just because I feel like I could have actually had the avenues and routes to get to that level.
Well, yeah, and just for our listeners, this new Athletes Unlimited Softball League, it's first of its kind. It's right now starting with four teams, kind of a barnstorming league that's exposing fans across the country to the game. But there are visions to bring this up to 10 or 12 teams. And Katie, it's funny you brought up how kind of the speed of the game and the, you know, kind of the drama and a little bit of the pace of baseball is probably more like watching a chess game in some places. What I've noticed with the softball game, it's got a little bit of a pinball vibe to it, right? So you better be on your toes. And I think today's generation, which has a very, not a long thought span and, you know, kind of this new video game generation, I think softball might be able to play into their emotion a little bit more.
I agree, for sure.
Kate, you still coach softball, right? As part of your own business?
Yeah, I offer private lessons, and I've been doing some motivational speeches with some of the younger all-star teams to get them prepped and ready for their season.
What do you see in the young athletes you work with today in terms of, like, what their aspirations are for playing in college or potentially going pro, going to Olympics? I mean, do you hear them talking outwardly about that?
Oh, absolutely. One of my lessons actually recently had talked to this, like, recruiting company, and she's like all about going to Florida already, you know, because you see them in the Women's College World Series and you just identify with, hey, I'm like that girl, or I want to be like that girl. So I think having those role models on TV for these girls to see, and also social media with the Instagram and the TikTok and all that stuff, like, it's giving these girls so much more access to see what they can do.
Now you've got to listen to this whole episode. Katie tells a great story of meeting George Bush when she was 11 years old, and we'll say she was maybe a little underwhelmed, but the president was excited. She also talks about the work she's doing now as a public speaker, working to influence other young women in sports. Next up is Rob Perez from the Tri-City Chili Peppers, which is not a regular baseball team. The Tri-City Chili Peppers actually started a cosmic baseball league. You already heard Mike Buczkowski talk about how that is one of his sports to watch. Rob happens to agree, no surprise. Let's listen back.
So Rob, you launched this first at Shepherd Stadium, was kind of the first debut of cosmic baseball. And then where did it go from there?
Yeah. So after June 1st, the first Cosmic game, fans started posting the videos, and ESPN actually did a special segment on SportsCenter that night dedicated to Cosmic Baseball. We came in the next day and our phones were ringing off the hook. Fans were actually crashing our ticketing website because they wanted tickets. And the other three games we had sold out within hours of each other on that day. And so fans also requested more games, and we weren't for sure how many tickets we were talking about. And we put up a lottery request, and fans had requested an additional 20,000 tickets.
Wow.
Now for us, this is amazing because Shepherd Stadium, we sell out at 2,400. So we knew we could do more games. So we added two more games. Those games sold out, And it was at that time which minor league teams had started reaching out to us, asking us if we would take this on the road in 2025. And after doing a little bit of research and discussion amongst our team and doing some site visits, we ultimately said, yes, we would do this. And we narrowed it down to seven teams, and we could have added more, but we knew this is our first tour. So it's very much a learning year for us to make sure we understand how to effectively execute a tour and doing Cosmic Baseball on a larger scale. So we decided on those teams. We worked with the host sites and their staff to look at promotion of the Cosmic Games happening at their stadiums. And then we launched the lottery system because people still had to sign up for the opportunity to get tickets at each of the sites. And then eventually we launched into ticket sales. And at this point, we are able to do two sold out games at each location that we are going to this summer. So that has been an awesome response to fans from a larger regional area.
I have so many questions, and I want to, Rob, start with this one. How do you train the players to do this? I mean, do you have to train the players to, you know, essentially like play glow-in-the-dark baseball?
Absolutely. And that was something we actually did before even launched our first game, because how do we make sure that a player who's standing on the field when he's batting can actually see the ball coming in? And how can the fielders, how do they feel when they're reacting to a ball that's hit their way? Is this something they're going to be able to see? And so we'd practice with them under the black lights. We adjusted the black lights to make sure the stadium was covered and that dead spots or dark spots didn't exist. We were able to make it a safer experience for the players. And I will say that I can actually see the baseball better during Cosmic Baseball than I can a regular game at night, because the ball is that reactive and stands out under the black lights in the night.
So the ball is glow in the dark, the bat, the gloves, the uniforms, just kind of paint this picture for our listeners.
Absolutely. So yeah, so all the player uniforms are reactive, and we have a variety of colors within those uniforms. We have two teams, the Cosmic Chili Peppers, and a brand new team we introduced this year called the Glowmojis. And so everything is reactive that they're wearing usually. The gloves, not quite yet. That's one of the harder pieces to actually get to be reactive. There are certain elements like lacing and lettering on the gloves that can be reactive. So we're still doing a little bit more work on that aspect. But the bats, the baseball, the bases themselves, UV reactive powder we can sprinkle on the ground, that is all reactive. And then behind you, you have the fans in their Cosmic shirts, jerseys, hats, and other apparel that's also UV reactive. And so once we do the transition to turning on the black lights, that is an incredible visual sight to be a part of and to see in pictures and video as well.
Wow.
Without giving away too many secrets, and this is something where we have to educate the fans, is that for the first part of the game, we do it without the black lights, because black lights obviously don't work when the sun is out. And so we do about an hour of what you might consider traditional baseball, but we change up the rules of that part and make it more fun and entertaining for the fans. And then once it's 30 minutes after the sunset, that's when we turn on the black lights with the dramatic transition. And it is awesome to see everybody's reaction to the special effects that we have as a part of this experience. And there are, let's see, at least three or four different special effects that go into this experience beyond the black lights.
Now, Major League Baseball has been making rule changes to obviously make the game quicker, make the game a little more exciting for the next generation of fans. I'm interested to know, Rob, what other rule changes that Cosmic Baseball has?
You know, actually for us, we also do look at the time in between pitches and the transition time between half innings, because we want to keep the action ongoing for the fans. We really don't want that dull, dead period going on for too long. So we do look at the timing piece. We also look at how do we make it more entertaining for the fans. So there is one inning in which we usually play baseball a little backwards. So if the batter gets a hit, rather than running to first, he's got to change his mind there and actually run to third and run the bases backwards. And sometimes, because we're on that habit of running to first, you sort of head off that way. Then you realize, oh, man, I have to run the other way. And so you have to head towards third.
Hey, by the way, Rob, when I was coaching Little League Baseball, you know, those five-year-olds would automatically run to third base anyway.
They would be all set for Cosmic Baseball.
Right in.
The goal here is to bring more energy and, if we're being real about it, more entertainment to the sport of baseball. Next is a clip where Rob talks about the Savannah Bananas, although frankly we had to push him to say the name a little bit, and where improvisational sports really got their start.
You and Tim were alluding to the Savannah Bananas, and mm-hmm. there's obviously, you know, they have wind, you know, behind their sails, lots of momentum, introducing people to the game. And by the way, the Savannah Bananas didn't invent, I guess what I was also termed kind of improv sports. Oh, there's been a mm-hmm. franchise around called the Harlem Globetrotters that actually, yeah. I would say, started this. And to the Savannah Bananas' credit, they've been very successful the last few years. I see what you guys are doing. It's super exciting. There's, you know, getting the younger generation involved in the game. Believe it or not, it might be cosmic baseball that could be this child's first baseball game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I love that. What do you think about potential of other cosmic sports? Could this, I'm just brainstorming here because Tim and I here on Skin in the Game always brainstorm ideas. Could this translate to flag football? Could this translate to basketball? Where could this global go?
Well, I'll say yes and yes. And I'll tell you about the discussions we've already had about that and what we've done so far. But first, thank you for the throwback to the Harlem Globetrotters. They were here in our Colonial Heights area in the spring, and we went and saw them. And that was a great experience to see, to me, sort of like the innovators
exactly.
of the sports entertainment area. And so it actually gave us a few ideas as well about how we continually engage the fans and be creative out on the field with what we do. So it was great being there. But for other sports, we actually have a new entity called Cosmic Sports, in which the goal of that is to look at how do we work with other sports leagues to bring a cosmic experience to them. With one of those leagues, we already did that. So during Super Bowl week in New Orleans this past February, we actually did a cosmic flag football experience with the NFL. And so Toyota was the major sponsor of that experience. And that really was our first trial run with our new blacklight system. And so it was a good experience for us. The kids enjoyed it, and it let us know, yeah, we could do this. We could actually expand to other sports. So we've got the football. After that experience, additional flag football teams contacted us about also doing a cosmic flag football experience. So we may be looking into that more. Our owner, Chris Martin, had been in contact and discussions with the Toledo Walleye hockey team about a cosmic experience. So there could be something on the horizon there. I've had a chance to meet with a team from the NBA G League about a cosmic experience, and also mentioned the cosmic experience as a possibility to an executive of a WNBA team. So there is a great possibility of cosmic being in other sports. It's a matter of what we're able to work out with them and having the staff to be able to do that.
We'll be right back with more of our Skin in the Game baseball special. You know I love a good baseball book. Next, we're going to be talking to a pair of authors who kept me reading straight through the summer.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
From your morning commute to quiet evenings at home, Buffalo Toronto Public Media is always there. With trusted news, inspiring stories, and timeless music, it's your connection to a world of wonder. This is Public Media.
For the last segment of our baseball special on Skin in the Game, we bring you two authors who wrote about baseball from decidedly different perspectives. First is Will Bardenwerper, the author of Homestand, Small Town Baseball and the Fight for the Soul of America. Will, your young son's name is Bates, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, there's an incredible scene. John, I'll stop. But, well, so John, you can make the point. But Will and Bates go to this game, and yet Keep going.
Well, you were, I think, and there's a couple facts I may miss, but you know, you were $150 into the experience before you even sat down. And unfortunately,
there's a season ticket, right?
Yeah,
there.
Unfortunately, you were probably in the upper deck. Your son couldn't recognize what was happening on the field. And in spite of it being probably one of the best professional stadiums, professional venues, I think you ended up leaving in the fourth inning.
Yeah, that was, you know, kind of a demoralizing or disillusioning experience. And you're right, PNC Park's a great place to go to a game. But, you know, one of the unfortunate sort of consequences of this book was just kind of opening my eyes to some of the business decisions that MLB has made, I think, to the detriment of their fans. And it made something that should be kind of a simple source of pleasure between a father and a son a little bit more difficult to enjoy. There's another, I don't think it was that same outing, but I've written about it subsequently, where I waited with Bates outside the visiting team's clubhouse because I knew where the buses were. And I'm not a big autograph guy, but I thought he'd get a kick out of maybe getting an autograph from one of the players. And long story short, the Mets were the team that was visiting, and they start to emerge one by one, and everyone's shouting, hoping that a player will make a detour and come over and sign something. And of course, you know, none of them do. A few of them kind of wave half-heartedly. And, you know, so my son and I walk away. He's completely dejected. And I think to myself, my initial thought was, well, let's cut these players a break. They're busy. They're hounded for autographs everywhere they go. And then I step back and I remember I had done the math on some of the salaries that they earn. And it occurred to me that a few of the players actually had earned over $200,000 for that afternoon's game. And I thought to myself, wait a second, if you made $200,000 in the last 5 hours, you should be signing autographs until your pen runs out of ink. And then though, but I'll just wrap the story up because this is kind of an illustration of, I think, what I was trying to get at with some of this book. As we were making our way to our car, an older gentleman who in an usher's uniform shouts to us and he says, "Hey, come here." And I don't really know what to make of this or what to expect. And he pulls a ball out of what looked to be like a lunch bag that he had brought that day and tosses it to my son. And he said, "Here's a game used ball." And he completely rescued the day. My son was absolutely overjoyed. And that usher, I had also recently read that they had just fought to increase their wage from like, you know, $9 an hour to $12 an hour. So it just, I thought that was like the perfect sort of microcosm of what is kind of right and wrong about the game, all in that one afternoon.
Yeah. And well, how much roughly did MLB quote unquote save by cutting 40 of their clubs, you know, out of the system?
Generally speaking, and this may not be absolutely precise, but what I heard was somewhere in the neighborhood of $700,000 per team per season that was cut to their parent organization. So you figure, to put it in context, that is one major league minimum salary about. To also put it in context, that is about what some of these superstars will make in about three or four games, maybe even fewer for some of the top stars. And so it, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's a really inconsequential amount of money given the sums of money we're talking about.
Will spent an entire season with the Batavia Muck Dogs. He got to know the fans, the players, the coaches, everybody in baseball operations, and the owners.
I was talking, I think, to Bill Kaufman, who's the Batavia writer that I got to know in the course of doing this. And I shared with him this New York Yankees promotion, and it was just kind of a media release explaining how they had this new AI-driven app that would help, I think, manage or govern your ballpark experience. And Bill said to me, he's like, "Geez, like, we've been going to the ballpark for 100 years without AI helping." He's like, "How hard can it be to find your way to your seat and buy a hot dog? You know, do we really need a new app that's AI, you know, generated in order to help us do this?"
Bill was one of many great characters you share with readers in the book. Two more who jumped out at me, and you mentioned them a few moments ago, is Robbie Nichols and his wife Nellie Nichols. The Nichols own, is it two college league baseball teams, right? Elmira and Batavia.
And they just bought the Niagara team, I believe. So now it's three.
So they got three. Okay. So now, if we're just stop there, here's a couple, and Robbie's a former pro athlete, who own three minor league baseball teams. It would sound like they're, financially, they're flying pretty high. But then again, you're also pointing out Robbie will flip burgers right along with his employees at the games. And so tell us the reality for Robbie and Nellie Nichols, or, you know, people like them who own these very small, either really really small pro team or a college summer league team. What is the financial model? And I mean, is this a great investment? Is this a passion investment? What is it?
Well, it really depends. I don't know if there's a single answer to that. First of all, just to be clear, these are collegiate teams that they own. So they're not minor league teams.
Right,
collegiate teams, I think, are even less lucrative than a minor league team would be. And some minor league teams actually, to be clear, can be very profitable. I think the wood bat, I don't think anyone's going to enter the collegiate wood bat business looking to get rich. It's just not, the margins are super thin. They make their money off of some combination of ticket sales, concessions, maybe some local advertising. And the players actually pay a small fee to be on the team. And that helps defray the cost of bus rides and equipment and uniforms, the dorms that they spend the summer playing at. And the owners kind of come in all shapes and sizes. Now, Robbie and Nelly are very hardworking, sort of hustling entrepreneurs that definitely are, this is their job. They do this 18 hours a day and are trying to do the best they can financially. Other owners, it's more of, like you said, more of like either a side hustle, or they have, money coming in from elsewhere, and this is just something they like to do. But I think in some cases you can actually tell the difference based on the product on the field, and that Robbie needs this to succeed. He needs people to come to the ballpark because that is what pays the bills. Whereas if this is kind of just something you do as a lark, I think that's where sometimes you see the product suffer, because there's really not the same urgency to make it as good as it can be. And you can see that in the attendance numbers in these leagues. Robbie routinely will pull in 3,000, 4,000 people, but there's other teams in this league that are lucky to get 300. And so I think when you look at, is this a financially viable model? One of the things that I think would worry me, and I'm sure worries Robbie, is you can't just have three successful teams to make a league. You need like 10 of them. And so the other teams need to pull their weight and need to do as good of a job as he is doing.
That's a great point. And it's, you're only as good as, your weakest link.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
You see that a lot of other leagues, that's why they have centralized decision making and shared services. But, these are a lot of independent entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you're also dependent on them fielding a good team so that
mm-hmm.
you can have some competitive balance and provide mm-hmm. a better product at the end of the day, product to the fans in attendance.
Our final clip is from a guy I know well and I had the pleasure of working with at the Buffalo News. He's also one of my favorite writers, Mark Sommer. Now, Mark had never written a book, but he grew up as a huge baseball fan, and he always had an interest in Rocky Colavito. Mark chased this story for a while, and the result was the book Rocky Colavito, Cleveland's Iconic Slugger. How open was Rocky to sitting down and talking with you?
He was really open. So to get his number, I reached out to the Cleveland Guardians front office. Someone, John, I know that you do know, Bobby DiBiasio, longtime executive with the team.
Yep.
But I didn't know him from a hole in the wall. I really didn't. I just got lucky. Talked to him on the phone. We talked for a bit. He told me that Rocky had been his favorite player growing up, and that he didn't ordinarily give out Rocky's number, but he gave out Rocky's number to me. So I called Rocky, and Rocky said he had wondered many years if anyone was going to write a book about his life. I started taking notes that day and didn't stop.
And just for our listeners, I just want to kind of put this in perspective, how dominant of a player he was. And again, Mark, probably that, 56, 57 to 68, and maybe four or five of those years, he was one of the players in Major League Baseball, but 374 home runs. I think, as he retired, he was really probably in the top 20 all-time home run hitters.
He was. And, like that 374 home runs today doesn't look like a lot. I mean, it's a lot, but it pales compared to a lot of other players. But in its day, and I think you have to look in the context of the times in which he played, he had the third most home runs of any right-handed American League hitter in history.
Yeah.
Even like Roger Maris, who was a teammate of his and a close friend, he had 275 home runs in his career, but that was fifth most for left-handed hitters in that time. He's not in the Hall of Fame, and like Rocky, I would argue that they probably both should be, mm-hmm. but you have to look back in the day when they put them together.
Yeah. Now, one reason I wanted to bring you in studio, yes, I think we know on this show, I have an affinity for Cleveland as my hometown. But to me, I found this book much beyond just the boundaries of Northeast Ohio. And I just think the popularity of Rocky Colavito and what he meant to the residents of that region in the late 50s, I can only compare it to kind of the affinity that you see with a Josh Allen in Western New York. And Tim, I'm looking to you, and it's like you read the book and you know what someone like Josh Allen means to Western New York. That's probably the closest I can get to comparing just how important he was to that organization.
Yeah, it really got me thinking about what a player means to a city, what the city means to a player, what the fans mean to a player. Mark, I was reading your book on the same weekend as I watched the first episode of Hard Knocks inside the training camp series with the Buffalo Bills. You see Josh Allen just methodically working his way through an autograph line. And it seems like he's doing it every practice. I don't know if he is. Then I'm reading your book and reading about Rocky Colavito, and you can help me out here, lining up the kids, right? Telling them to line up. Which was both his way of saying, don't get ink on my clothes, but I'm going to take care of every one of you if you're polite and you wait. If you're patient, I'm patient, and we're going to spend some time together. Did Rocky care about the fans in a way that's similar to the way that they cared about him?
Yeah, he really did. And, you know, he grew up in the shadow of Yankee Stadium. He's from the Bronx, and he idolized Joe DiMaggio. So Joe DiMaggio was the first really great and popular Italian-American ball player. So he kind of patterned himself after Rocky. He didn't grow up with a lot of money in the household, but he would always dress really nice when he went out in public as he became a professional athlete. And just, you know, he really wanted to represent himself in the best way possible. And that included, as you were pointing out, at home games, he would just line up the fans after virtually every home game. I mean, there's so many stories about him doing that. And I didn't have to hear it from him. I heard it from so many of his teammates who marveled at the amount of time and patience he would show after, you know, game after game. He would be out there a couple of hours with the kids if necessary, and he would line them up and he would sort of make sure they were polite and all that stuff. But he wanted every last kid to get the autograph from him because they, you know, he wanted to be someone that they could look up to. And I think that was one of the things that endeared Rocky to Cleveland fans. Another was he was Italian-American. And, you know, Italian-Americans suffered an incredible amount of racism and discrimination throughout the early 20th century, certainly. Italian-Americans looked up to Rocky. He was just sort of the role model, the ultimate role model. It wasn't just Italians who loved Rocky in Northeast Ohio, which made his trade, which I know you're going to want to get into, all the more shattering when it occurred.
Finally, we talked with Mark about the general manager at the time, a guy named Frank Lane, and something called the Curse of Colavito.
There was a general manager who traded Rocky by the name of Frank, nicknamed Trader Lane. I mean, he had Minnie Minoso. He had Roger Maris.
Norm Cash.
Rocky Colavito. I mean, Tommy John. There's Louis Tiant. I mean, there's all these Hall of Fame players, which, by the way, we'll talk about where Rocky nets out there. He trades them all away. I mean, this guy also traded a manager for another manager. I mean, just think about that in the context of today's sports.
When he came in October of 57, I had to look this up to remind myself. On the 40-man roster that he inherited when he came to the team, 3 years and 3 months later when he left the team, only one of those players was still on the team. And he had traded that player, a guy named Russ Nixon, but the commissioner had voided that deal.
Yeah.
And he was kind of an impossible human being by all accounts. He was very narcissistic. It seemed like he resented players getting more attention than he did. Almost like, I'm going to get rid of this guy because, you know, he's taking attention away from me. As crazy as that sounds.
Yeah. When you think about all these players they had and you think about, you know, what they could have been if they kept them all together, that may have ended the curse of Colavito back then for sure.
Yeah, Mark, I actually want to ask you about that Curse of Colavito. What is your take on it? You believe it? What goes through your mind?
I think it's fun. You know, there is something about these curses because you can look at the trajectory of how long they seem to last. And in the case of Cleveland, it's still continuing. But, you know, I don't know that it's more than that. I asked Rocky about the curse, of course, and he would react angrily to the curse because he was interpreting it as that he personally put a curse on. Like, I never did that. Like, no one really thinks you did that. It's just the trade sort of brought a curse to bear. Calavito gets traded. Team's fortunes plummet, and they still haven't won a damn World Series, right?
I would say it's the Frank Lane curse, actually, because he's the one that drove that. You mentioned, Rocky didn't get along with a lot of his GMs and a lot of his managers. How much of that was Rocky and his personality and his pride versus maybe, as he referred to, some of the incompetency of the managers and the GMs?
Yeah, I think some of it definitely had to do with Rocky. He was very temperamental, and if he felt someone had crossed him, well, then they were on a list they were not coming back from, probably. As he once said to me, Mark, this is business. And when he talked about business, it was different than the way he talked about other things. I think he learned this from his brother Dominic, who was kind of a tough guy, kind of a hood, really, who, when his mom died at 9, played a primary role in helping to raise Rocky. And when it came to negotiations, Rocky was very tough and not usually satisfied with what the outcome was. That was my experience.
Yeah, and this was before agents and before representation.
It was, So you'd go in there with the general manager and kind of duke it out.
His job was to say all the things you were doing wrong. Your job was to say, here's all the things I'm doing right. There was no liaison to buffer any of that.
There wasn't. So, I certainly can glean that through what I've read in his past and from talking to him, and a little bit of even what I experienced being around him. So there was that side to him.
Yeah.
That wraps up this Skin in the Game baseball special. Check out all of our full episodes at btpm.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Skin in the Game is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. For John Simperman and myself, Tim O'Shea, thanks for listening.